This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Well, nothing stands still for too long in the world of business and commerce, the world of creative destruction, as some have called it, as products are created and discarded, along with fashions and fads about how to market said products. These days, marketeers are particularly challenged because of the huge range of communications outlets which have undermined, though not completely scuttled, the notion of the mass market. What's also new, according to those who watch these things closely, is that the consumers are being given the power to speak far more than ever before, through things like the World Wide Web, which not only offer opportunities to register your responses easily, but change the whole mentality of the consumer. Therefore, marketeers have to shift just as substantially, and it's pushing them hard to develop beyond the great hallmark of promotional behaviour of the last 20 years, branding. Now, one man at the forefront of this rethink is Kevin Roberts. He's the CEO at head office of Saatchi & Saatchi, the advertising agency and big trendsetter. He claims that branding should no longer be the tool of choice, that it's more than that, it's about creating a love mark. Well, we've grasped him from his busy schedule, and he joins us from his New York office. Kevin Roberts, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you, Geraldine.
So what's a love mark?
It's a brand that has added mystery, sensuality and intimacy to its already high kind of performance, trust and reputation. It's established an emotional connection with the consumer far beyond its benefits or attributes. It's moved, if you like, from being irreplaceable to becoming irresistible. Think about the Apple iPod, for example. You can replace an MP3 player any day of the week, but the iPod, you can't replace that because it's irresistible. You're in love with it.
It's a part of the person's identity, you're saying?
Yeah, I think, you know, that people now are absolutely inundated with parity performing products. I mean, they know that, you know, anti-dandruff shampoos get rid of shampoo. They know that moisturizers make your face soft. They know that beer tastes good, unless you live in America like me, but they know all these kinds of things. So what they're looking for is something beyond performance, something beyond a transaction. They're looking for a relationship. They're looking for something that feels that it understands them, the consumer.
It's still about branding, though, isn't it? Making sure that the brand sticks in people's minds. You're doing it in a very sophisticated fashion, but isn't it branding?
You know, I think sticking in your mind is no good anymore. I mean, you've got to be embracing the consumer and touching her heart. She goes into, you know, a Woolworths or a Coles or a Franklin's or David Jones or whatever, Grace Brothers, and she stands in front of a counter for about, you know, 2.5 to 3 seconds. She doesn't think with her head at that stage. She thinks with her heart. She feels, you know, how is she being moved? Sensorially, what are these products doing to her? She's not, you know, it's not a life and death decision. 80% of decisions are made emotionally, and kind of 80% of marketing is done rationally. There's a real mismatch there. So 80% of our decisions and our feelings are made rationally. In fact, emotionally. Even when you buy a house, Geraldine, you know that you just somehow sit there and stand there and it feels right. No matter what the brochure said, what the auction said, what the price is, all that rational stuff. Same thing with a car. You can look at the performance, you can look at the quality, yada, yada, but you're going to make your mind up because there's something that connects with you, either in its advertising, its design, or its look.
And are you saying, therefore, that in a way marketing has been appealing to this 80% rationality over the years, or it's had an emphasis encouraging people to make a decision, and it's lost or it hasn't looked at that fundamentally huge area of emotion?
Yeah, what's happened, I think, is that I used to work for Procter & Gamble and PepsiCo and Gillette, right? And when I was working there in the 80s and 90s, brands had all the power. You know, if you were Coca-Cola or PepsiCo, man, you had the power. Then what happened, obviously, in the late 90s is all that power switched to distribution. So it was the retailer that had the power. You know, Walmart's the world's biggest company. And if you look at the supermarkets, Coles and all those kind of things, they called the shots in Australia. Now that power has switched inexorably to the consumer. The consumer is boss, and she's loving it. And she's deciding what she buys, when she buys, how she buys, and she's making that call given a sound foundation of performance, distribution, all this normal marketing stuff. And on top of that, she's really responding to, does this brand understand me? Most brands are still kind of controlled and owned by brand owners. And the consumer's saying, no, listen, I want this to be interactive. I want to have my say in the brand. The brand does not, Coca-Cola doesn't belong to Amatil Coca-Cola Company. It belongs to me, the drinker of Coca-Cola. And I want my say now. And consumers are voting. You know, that's why YouTube, MySpace, all these networking sites are so potent and so viable, because the consumer is boss.
Yes. I wonder if there's a distinction between the humdrum domestic routine brands that we need, the toothpaste, the toilet cleaner, the toilet paper, that we really don't wish to engage. Certainly I don't. That's been part of the success of the no-names brands rise. And I know there's a great debate about just how durable that is. But versus these special items that you will splash on that mean something to you, like the iPod or the beautiful perfume or the lovely carpet you want.
Yeah, I've written a book, right, called Love Marks. We've just written a new one called The Love Marks Effect that's out in December. And we have a website, www.lovemarks.com, and you will be amazed. All consumer stories, 140 countries, consumers are coming in, emailing us about their Love Marks. Charmin is a toilet tissue or toilet paper in the U.S., and it's got a bear as its kind of, and it charges a 15% premium, not because it's softer or it lasts longer or whatever, but there is this, believe it or not, emotional connection between many consumers and this. Laundry detergent, which you would think is kind of a functional kind of product, right? In the U.S., there's a brand called Tide, which is the leading brand, and that has an attachment to housewives in America. That has nothing to do with getting clothes clean. It has all to do with being a new good mom and all this kind of stuff. And the emotional feedback that they give us to Tide is enormous. It's kind of a love mark drives loyalty beyond reason.
So can you tell me some of the best examples of this love marking that you're seeing around you now?
Yeah.
You've mentioned this one already, the intriguing one about the toilet paper.
A love mark for me is Qantas. You know, I know Qantas has its ups and downs with the Australian public, but I used to live in Sydney when I was running Lion Nathan and the Tui's Brewery and Castlemaine Forex and everything back there in the early 90s. And I would always fly Qantas to the Far East or to the US. Everybody talked about Singapore Airlines and Cathay and all this stuff, but I liked it. It would always something, in about 1993, I was getting into the first class cabin of the pointy end, thank goodness, for a long haul back from London to Sydney. And when I got in, this Qantas steward said to me, would you like a glass of Chardonnay, sir, or would you like a beer, mate? And I said, mate, I'll have a beer. And from there on in, it was like 20 hours, I was in an intimacy, a home-like environment, you know?
Mm.
And I think that's what made Qantas then a love mark for me. So I would pay a premium to fly Qantas because of the way they made me feel. Not because of the seats and all that.
So it wasn't actually their external message. Sorry to interrupt you. I see. So I thought you meant that love marks were very much the public face, but you're saying it's deeper than that.
Oh, great point, Geraldine. I am, absolutely. You can't hide from anyone now because, see, branding has been replaced by the experience. Okay, Qantas advertising can say what it wants, and you can have koalas wherever you want and kangaroos all over the plains. And all that's very important, right? But equally important is every time you touch Qantas, what's their website like? What is their check-in like? What are the people like, you know, in the cabins? What is the follow-up like? How easy is it to buy a ticket and so on and so forth? And that's the same with shampoos. It's the same with laundry detergent. It's the same in everything now. Consumers are so demanding and so savvy, they will give you no leeway whatsoever. You cannot hide behind a brand. You cannot hide behind a logo. And by the way, you can't hide behind no logo and no branding, because consumers are getting a little bit tired of that. They're saying, well, wait a minute. You know, I want to know more about you. Are you sustainable? Are your labor practices good? Are you socially good? Are you ethically strong? Are you environmentally sound? And if you've got no branding on it, gee, how do I find that out?
I've often raised this before. I think Toyota is another very interesting example that is this giant, worldwide, complicated brand, pretty good brand, Toyota, but the need to, it can be amorphous and huge. I think they're still the... I think they're the second biggest seller in Australia.
They're number one in Australia.
They are number one now, are they?
Right. We handle them in Australia.
Okay. Yeah. But how do... I'm intrigued as to how you develop love marks in the middle of that huge amorphous thing called Toyota.
Fantastic. 5 years ago, Yoshi Ishizaka, who actually used to live in Melbourne with Toyota, he was running the whole of the world for Toyota. And he said, Kevin... Toyota is the most respected car company in the world. And I think you'd agree with that, right? And he said to me, but now I want you to make it the most loved. Oh, wow, you know? So how are they doing it? They're doing it through their focus has been on this thing called QDR, quality, durability, reliability. And now they're saying, well, on top of that, we want to add great design. We want to add young cars for the youth market called Scions. We want to bring in, you know, the hybrid electric car, the Prius, that is really great for the environment. So that
that's done them a lot of good, I agree.
Absolutely. Mm. So we want to give power to the people, and we know you don't want to screw up the environment. So here's a Prius.
Was the Prius... the love mark amidst the brand Toyota? This is what I'm just trying to tease out.
I think Camry is, you know, Prius is a love mark, no question. I think the Yaris...
The Camry's not a love mark, is it? Please don't tell me it is.
In America, do you know...
I think it's the dullest car.
Yeah, in America, it is the biggest selling car in America for the last 5 years. Listen, it sells 450,000 units. And people love it. They just love it because it's it's the kind of car that you can drive, that it kind of feels like, you know, the interior of a Camry now in the U.S. is extremely luxurious. It feels like a Lexus experience with a Toyota price. And it's for those people who actually don't need to leave the car outside to say something about themselves. They use it because it's... quality, durable, reliability,
defaming the Camry. Now, tell me some product or group that has gone...
Prius, though, Geraldine.
Pardon?
We've got to get you into it.
Got to get me into it. Righto. Tell me something that's losing the plot about this. I mean, I'd like you to name the beast, too. You won't have their account, I realise that. But somebody who has... I'm just trying to think myself of a product or a brand.
Well, I can tell you a story of one that you'll know very well, which is Nike, okay? And I know Nike really well, you know. And Nike started life as a product. It was an athletic shoe, you know, that was lighter and, you know, you could run quicker in it, and it had that particular waffle sole. It then became a brand when they added, you know, Just Do It and the Nike swoosh and all that great marketing to it. And then it moved from being a brand selling shoes at $80 to being a way of life, to being a love mark when it was endorsed by Michael Jordan, fundamentally. And Jordan elevated that brand to a love mark. So their pricing went through the roof, their sales went through the roof, and blah, blah, blah. But then what happened was this whole Asian manufacturing labor kerfuffle. And they got caught in this, you know, corporate crossfire of, you know, labor practice, and they lost their love mark status. It dropped back to being a brand, and then Adidas became strong, and Reebok became stronger. Now, Nike have moved back into love mark status through sponsoring more and more local teams, local cricket, local rugby, local Aussie rules, and so on. So they've been on a journey from product to brand to love mark to brand to love mark. And the journey is manifested, really, in terms of the price premium you can command. Because the only point of brands was to command a price premium, right? You know, to charge more, right? To justify more. And the premium's got out of branding now because brands have fundamentally become commodities, hence this no-name stuff. Love marks take you back out of commodities, and they take you back into premiums.
Very interesting. Thank you very much. I might invite the listeners to let us know their own case studies or stories of love marks or that have gone right or wrong. It's very interesting once you start to think about them. Kevin Roberts, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Geraldine. Bye.
And Kevin is the Chief Executive Officer Worldwide of Saatchi & Saatchi, so he speaks with some authority.